Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media right here in Troy, New York, and I'm Lavonia Mallory. Today, we'll be hearing from Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey, who covered an assembly primary debate between candidates competing for the Democratic line in the 107th District of New York Assembly District. And we'll also be talking to Dr. Kajufu, talking about his book, The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys. And then lastly, we'll be talking to Ceci Alfonso, a pioneer in the Forensic Capital Punishment Case Mitigation Program. But first, let's have some very brief rapid-fire headlines. A scathing grand jury report this week on rampant abuse in six Pennsylvania dioceses accused Cardinal Wuerl of helping to protect some child molesting priests while he was Bishop of Pittsburgh from 1988 to 2006. The Vatican expressed shame and sorrow. Privacy advocates continue to criticize Google as several Google apps and websites continue to store users' locations, even if the users have turned off the location history. Aretha Franklin, the Queen of Soul, transitioned from life on Thursday. She said, "I don't think I was a catalyst for women for the women's movement," she told the Rolling Stone in 2014. "Sorry, but if I were, so much the better." An Albany County assistant district attorney accused of working on criminal cases beyond his duties with the county has now resigned. Stephen Sharp was doing freelance work on a number of big cases. His actions raised concerns about conflict of interest and violated district attorney policies. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine, 105.3 FM. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. Or if you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004. On Tuesday, August 15, two candidates vying for the Democratic line in November's election to represent the 107th Assembly District met at a candidate forum hosted by Cambridge and White Creek Democratic Committees. Tricia Haltling and Don Boyojin answered questions on a wide range of topics from climate change to gun control. And Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey brings us this report.
The candidates agreed on many public policy positions, but distinguished themselves in a number of key ways. Boyajian, arguing that he is uniquely situated to square off against a Republican candidate with a well-funded campaign, and Haltling, emphasizing her working-class identity and ability to appeal to Republicans and independent voters. Let's take a listen to how the candidates responded to some of the questions. On the question of arts and economic development.
Communities like Cambridge and Chatham and Hudson have been creating microeconomies within their community based on arts and tourism. And it's a really wonderful way to bring tourism into your community for something that you are anyway. It's not creating something different. It's flourishing the arts that already exist in your community. They've done studies. The National Endowment for the Arts said participation in cultural activity directly correlates to an increase in civic engagement. Voting, it increases voter turnout. Volunteering, charitable work. These are all really important things. And art increases engagement by people. So historically, if you look back as far as the Renaissance, the reason they call it a Renaissance that's happening in Hudson, is that when art flourishes, the economy thrives. They are linked together. Aside from the economic benefit for communities by allowing art to flourish and thrive, art's good for your soul. It connects people to each other. It creates good humans. These are really important things, and these are things that we need right now. We need good humans. We need to make sure that we're nourishing our soul. So not only are we benefiting our economic development, We're benefiting the betterment of the people within our community. I'm a musician myself. I play in a band with my mom and my friend Doug. We are a folk singer-songwriter band. I play the guitar and the ukulele, and it makes me feel good. People who support the arts also support local businesses. So when they come to Argyle Brewing Company to watch live music, they're spending money on craft beer, local brew. They're filling their gas tanks at your gas station. They might be going out to dinner at your restaurant before they go to see the live show. So when you bring art into your community and you flourish the art and the music, you're also encouraging growth of all of your businesses. Because when people come in to Hudson, they're staying in hotels. They're spending money at restaurants. They're going to the shops during the day. In the town of Chatham, which is in Columbia County in our district, they have a main street that has flourished. Restaurants, local venues, art galleries have all flourished. And it's because they've concentrated and focused on what they have to offer, which is a lot of artists and artisans. And they've showcased those local talents, and people come from all over to see it. The Berkshires, which is 5 minutes from my hometown of New Lebanon, Tanglewood, Jacob's Pillow, people come from all over the world to attend these displays of art.
What a treat that we have two candidates that are both musicians, so we're going to have to do a jam session about candidates at some point. And who remembers who the richest person was in the 17th century? No? You probably remember some of the best composers of the 17th century, don't you? The greatest legacy that any culture leaves behind, in my opinion, is its artistic contributions. They last the test of time. So what can be done legislatively to bolster that? Because I was just looking at the statistics. New York State, $114 billion each year on average to the state economy. It employs nearly 500,000 people in New York State to arts and arts education. Now what they've done in the past with respect to the New York Council for the Arts, a lot of it's going down in New York City. But up here, it has an even more profound effect when we invest in our arts. And I think it segues in very closely with our agritourism economy up here. We have a lot to offer, and there's some synergies of people coming up here on weekends, and they want to go tour a farm, they want to go see a show, and we got to get them to stay here and to spend their money here. So one of the most pressing legislative issues that I see is the potential regulation of Airbnb, and they are trying to ratchet down on it. It's a very New York City-driven initiative. That would be so bad for our arts dollars and our agritourism dollars up here, because you can't be regulating somebody that's renting out their home through Airbnb like a hotel down in New York City. Now, the reason they're floating this until we get more upstate Dems is because we don't have enough upstate Dems. It's the exact problem that we've been suffering for a really, really long time. Yeah, we have a stout Democratic majority, but it is a very strong downstate majority.
The candidates responded to a question on food insecurity in a region that produces food.
Talking about farmers losing money and people needing food, again, I think that we can bridge that. I think we need to connect local food producers with jails and schools. What if Washington County Jail got all its dairy from Washington County farms? So right now, we have programs in our procurement policy that talk about, you know, minority women-owned businesses. Why can't we put something in place that says local New York products, right? So that our schools in New York State and our jails in New York State are providing food that's grown locally and make that connection. Not only are we supporting our farmers, we're also then giving access to fresh local food to people that are in the jails or to our students in school. We have farms right here, we have food, we have people that need it. We need to bridge that gap. So we need to support the farmers markets, the CSAs, make sure that New York State products are getting into places where the government, our tax dollars, are spending money on food anyway. Why not be spending it on New York State produced food?
And Boyajian had an interesting take on how we could reform the rules around SNAP benefits.
SNAP and WIC should be covering feminine hygiene products. Think about a young girl that can't afford her feminine hygiene products, her family's in poverty. You know what happens? She misses school. That is a pervasive problem. And that's something that I think if we all got loud on that as a fundamental part of our human rights, and that should be covered by SNAP and WIC, I think we could get that done quickly. I certainly will be supportive of that type of initiative at the state level.
Houtlang and Boyajian responded to a question about government transparency and campaign finance reform.
We got to be aggressive in the capital of Albany because it is a snake pit and it is accessible. And I take very strict pledges in terms of no corporate donations, but I'm going a step further. I'm creating a term limit on myself, and I think all members of the Assembly should be doing the same at this point. I believe the bottom of my gut in public service. I chose to live in upstate New York. If I'm going to live here, I want to make this place kick butt as much as possible. But I hope to do it in different capacities in my life, which is why I hope to do this job for 8 years at the maximum. And I won't do it any longer than that. If I haven't gotten things done for you in 8 years, I'm not in the right job. I'm not doing a good job. And I think more of our elected should take that pledge upon ourselves, because when we have new people, it brings in fresh ideas. That's why I'm so excited as a younger person getting involved in this. And when I go knock on doors all around the district and I see a young person at the door, I say, hey, it's our time. So you can count on two things from me. I will never accept a corporate PAC donation, and I will not serve for more than 8 years.
I'm also in support of term limits. I think that there was a sticker and it said, diapers and politicians are the same. They both need changing every once in a while for the same reason. So we need to make sure that our politicians aren't dirty. When I decided this was something I wanted to do, I wanted to be a public servant for all of you, I was told you need to raise $100,000, and my jaw probably dropped all the way to the ground because I'm a blue collar family. We don't make a lot of money. That's a lot of money, and it deters people from running. It deters people like you and I, the working class people of this district, from running. Because right now, you either need to be rich, or know a lot of rich people, or be for sale to a corporate PAC, to the NRA. And until we can get that money out of politics, we're not going to have the diverse perspectives that we need of all different socioeconomic statuses, all different genders, all different races. California recently passed a clean election reform that the government funds campaigns, and everybody gets the same amount. Imagine if we were on a level playing field. Imagine if every candidate had the same amount of money and couldn't accept money from anybody. They couldn't be beholden to anybody. That would be truly fair elections, where the best candidate would be elected because they're the best candidate, not because they have a lot of money or because they're rich.
I fully support doing publicly financed elections too, but we do need somebody that can beat an incumbent. I'm fortunate to have raised sufficient funds to actually get this job done. It's all great to stand for things, but if we don't get in the seat, we can never advocate. Now, the funds that we've raised, you know, I don't believe you have to know a bunch of rich people to get this done, because we raised more than enough money to get this done with an average donation of under $200. You might say, how could a 32-year-old do that? Well, remember that Armenian church I was at right before I came here? There also happens to be 3 million Armenians in the United States. So I've been fortunate to be able to raise money in small dollar donations from people in that circle, and that will stand the test of time, and you're not beholden to anybody. But at the end of the day, you need somebody that is going to be able to beat the Republican incumbent. And unfortunately, right now, in electoral politics, that requires having resources.
The candidates responded to a question on climate change.
Oh, brother, I'm going to need more than 2 minutes on this one. Now, look at all these flash floods we've been having. Does this seem normal to you? The consequences are all sorts of unpredictable things. One of the most magical rivers in the cold water fisheries in the United States is the Delaware River. Well, there was a flash flood there the other day. A train derailed right at the headwaters of it. It spilled 5,000 gallons of oil into the west branch of the Delaware. That's an unforeseen impact of climate change. We have to get aggressive on this. And for my whole life, I've seen energy issues and environmental issues and climate change put on the back burner. We have more potential here for solar and wind and biofuel than we'd ever realized. But we gotta get the power producers and the utility lobbies out of the equation. And I think the only way you're gonna do that is by having somebody that's worked on it for a long time, that's shown the test of time.
Right now, we have a head of an EPA that does not believe in climate change. Think about that for a minute. Here in New York State, we have to protect ourselves from all of the rollbacks that are happening on a federal level. Every day, they're rolling something back. Now the car emission levels. California has fought back. California has said, no, we are not going with these new federal levels. We are going to pass legislation that says we are going with what the federal levels were, and we're going to continue on the path that Obama had put in place to make less and less emissions in the next 5 years. Right now, we need to establish a separate emissions regime like California and the 12 other states that follow its standards. We need to say, as New York State, we are not required to follow what you're doing on a federal level, because what they're doing is backwards. They're rolling back environmental protections. We need to be rolling in more environmental protections. As a mother, I'm very concerned about the planet that we're leaving for our children. We must invest in renewable energy and implement green energy initiatives. Any new money that we're spending in New York State has to be for renewables.
One of the last questions was on the SAFE Act and gun control.
One reason that I think that this seat has been held by a Republican for 28 years is because of guns. You see anti-SAFE Act signs all over the district. I knock on people's door, they say, you're a Democrat? You're trying to take my guns. My husband is an avid hunter and sportsman. We are a responsible gun-owning family. So I can say to those unaffiliated and Republican voters, I'm not trying to take guns away from responsible gun-owning families. but I am looking to protect your children. I'm looking to make sure that your children are safe when they're in school. I think we can all agree that we don't need military assault rifles. When it comes to specifically the SAFE Act, my belief is that most people who are against the SAFE Act are upset with the way it was passed, not necessarily the legislation. It fuels the fear of big government when the government issues a message of necessity and the bill doesn't have the time to age for 3 days. That makes people go, something's wrong, they're passing bills in the middle of the night without the proper process. So most of the people that I've talked to that have an anti-SAFE Act sign in their lawn, you know, what are your oppositions to the SAFE Act? We don't like how it was passed. It was pushed through too quick, it didn't have the proper procedure in place.
Now I'm a lifelong gun owner and sportsman, and I reject the idea that you need to choose between protecting communities and protecting your constitutional rights. And I've been very outspoken. I was endorsed by Moms Demand Action. And I think it's important that we have somebody that can speak intelligently from a position of being a gun owner on these issues. Because the SAFE Act shows a bill that was jammed through that's not reflective of legislators that understand gun ownership. Now, going to this election, we need somebody that's going to get elected. Having somebody that has lived their life as an outdoorsman, as a gun owner, went to the military Catholic school in the district, came from the staunchly Republican Armenian community in the district, that buys you a lot of credibility in different sectors of this district. We need somebody that is a staunch Democrat, but that is going to appeal to the purpleness of this region. And I think I provide that.
Let's take a listen to the candidates' closing statements.
I just want to close with a little bit about why I'm running. I'm not running to be something. I'm running to do something. I know what it's like to be raised by a single mom on food stamps. I know what it's like to be raising my family in the district. I know what it's like to go back to work when my babies are 6 weeks old because we can't afford for me not to. I know what it's like to decide between going back to work or staying home because the cost of childcare isn't much less than the salary that I make. I know what it's like to have a mother that's not far away from having to decide to come live with us or to go into a nursing home, not because she can't live on her own, but because she can't afford, once retired, to pay her bills. I understand the battles facing our farmers. One of my closest friends works every single day farming cattle because she wants to bring clean, grass-fed beef to our community, but she struggles to put food on her own table. We need more working-class citizens in our government to speak to these very real needs in our community. We need more women in our government to fight against sexual harassment, to fight for equal pay, to fight for a woman's reproductive health rights. We need to ensure that our representation represents who we are as communities. How long has it been since you felt like your government truly listens to you? I'm going to bring all of the voices to the table. Because until we bring all of the voices to the table, we're not having proper representation. So when you're deciding who to vote for in this primary, the difference is this. I have real life experiences and know what it's like to walk in the shoes of so many people in this district who struggle every day. And there aren't enough people like us in Albany. Together, we can bring our voices back to Albany. And I hope for your support to help get there.
This election is about giving a voice to a district that has not had one in a long time. But it is more than that, and it's interesting we haven't brought it up tonight. In the federal government that we're living in, with this abomination in the White House, who keeps me up at night, keeps us all up at night, we need a safeguard against that. And New York State is a very important safeguard against what's happening in the federal government. Think that I live in an era where they let the fox in the hen house of the EPA. And they're letting polluters run the operation. As an environmentalist, I can't believe it. But you know what? We can lead on those issues in New York State. And you can be damn sure I'm going to lead on those issues as your member of the Assembly. To think that we're living in an era where Roe v. Wade is coming into question. I mean, how is that even possible? But you know what? You know, we're leading on that right now. We're going to codify Roe v. Wade. So this election is important on more fronts than we realize. It's important for giving our region a voice, and it's important for providing a very, very important safeguard against what's happening federal. And I would be honored to do that for you, to do it for 8 years and no more. And I'd be honored to have your help in the process. I look forward to delivering a big win with all your help. Thank you for coming tonight.
So you just heard highlights from the candidates from the forum held Tuesday, August 15th in Cambridge between the two candidates for the Democratic line and the 107th Assembly District. Up next, we have Jawana Kajufu, Dr. Jawana Kajufu, who was educated at Morgan State, Illinois and Union Graduate School. He has been a guest speaker at most universities throughout the U.S. and has been a consultant to most urban school districts. He has authored 40 books, including national bestsellers, Black Students, Middle Class Teachers, Keeping Black Boys Out of Special Ed, an African-American-centered response to Ruby Payne's poverty theory, raising black boys, understanding black male learning styles, and changing school culture for black males. His latest books are Educating Black Girls, Raising Black Girls, and Reading and Writing for Urban Survival. His work has been featured in Ebony and Essence magazine, and he has been a guest on BET, MSNBC, and his feat has been featured on Oprah. His work is used in online courses nationwide. We'd like to thank Dr. Kajufu for joining us. Doctor, are you there?
Yes, I am, Lavonia. Good to hear your voice.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored that you're joining us today to talk about young black boys. I have a little open discussion with you. I read your book, The Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, probably 30 years ago when I was in college. Jonah, don't say a word. 30 years ago when I was in college. And it was groundbreaking then, and I think it's relevant now. Can you tell me from your position right now, why aren't black boys graduating from high school at the same rate as their white male counterparts?
Well, that's a tough question, but let me just say this. Only 12% of black boys are proficient in reading by eighth grade. And there's a relationship between literacy and the incarceration rate. I mean, as you know, in one of the chapters of that book, Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, was the fourth grade syndrome. And I never knew when I wrote that particular chapter the governors were going to pimp my research like this and literally determine prison growth based on fourth grade reading scores. The objective was to have schools intervene, provide remedial reading, provide mentors, rites of passage, whatever enrichment programs they could provide to improve the test scores in fourth grade. It was not to be a precursor to build more prisons. But there's a myriad of reasons why black boys are not graduating from high school. One of my earlier books is titled Reducing the Black Male Dropout Rate. And Lavonia, one of the challenges is that since 1954, there's been a 66% decline in African-American teachers. So 83% of America's school teachers, elementary, are white and female.
Okay.
Only 6% are African-American, and only 1.5% are African-American male. So there are schools nationwide where there's not one black man in the building. And if a black man is there, I'm going to wager he's a security guard first, a janitor second, a PE teacher third, an administrator fourth, a high school teacher fifth, middle school sixth, and primary seventh. So black boys can literally go K-3, K-6, K-8, and never experience a black male teacher.
Wow. And you think the lack of a role model right in front of them plays that much of a significant role in their experience within the educational system?
Well, when I speak to black youth, and especially black male youth, and ask them, what are your career aspirations, what are your goals, what do you think they tell me? What are the three top choices?
Probably want to be a basketball player.
A basketball player, a rapper, or the first drug dealer never to be caught.
Right.
So they just don't see enough black males who are academically accomplished, who are doing well financially. So they emulate the people that they see.
Okay.
And there's also some conflicting research with regards to fathers. So not only is there a dearth of black males in the classroom, but some researchers say only 28% of black youth have their fathers in the home.
Mm.
Now, some say that it's not that bad. It's closer to 60%. What some researchers were doing were looking at the number or percent of fathers who married the mother of their children.
Okay.
If that's the case, it's only 28%.
Mm.
But if you look at the percent of fathers who actually spend time with their children, who live with their children, it's 61%.
So what is the black male learning style? What is that?
Well, again, I wish we had more time, and maybe we can come to your city and work with your school district, or maybe the radio station can have a forum where we can go into these issues in more detail. But let me just quickly say that most teachers use a written textbook, worksheet, left brain pedagogy with right brain, oral, visual, tactile, kinesthetic learners. Okay. And what I'm trying to help teachers to understand, you don't teach the way you want to teach. You teach the way your children learn. Okay. And if large numbers of black males are right brain learners, oral, tactile, kinesthetic, then implement those kinds of lesson plans in the classroom if you really want to be effective with black males.
You know, that's interesting. I go to Africa quite a bit, and most of their educational system is oral only because they don't have books. So there may be one book, two books, 10 books in the entire school, and the teachers may be the only one that have the books, so the rest of the kids learn orally from those teachers, and they are excelling.
Now, you know, what's interesting about that is that you probably have also seen some research where the group with the highest educational attainment in America are not whites, not Jews, not Asians. Who are they? Nigerians.
Oh, really?
Now, one of the things I've just done very unfairly, I've compared immigrants to slaves. I've compared a group that voluntarily came here with their culture intact, with the people forced to come here, where their culture was taken from them, and then they're given February, the shortest month of the year, to learn their history and their culture. But see, the good news, because I'm always looking for the good news in terrible research.
Okay.
And the good news is that you can overcome racism when you know your history and your culture.
Mm.
So rather than complaining about it,
right,
use your history to inspire you.
Okay. So, Doctor, if my listeners are out there, there's a teacher listening, how can they reach you? Do you have a Facebook page, a website, phone number? How can someone reach you if they want to invite you to their school to talk about educating young black boys?
Well, I appreciate that question. They can go to our website, AfricanAmericanImages.com, and if they click on radio, we have sets available for teachers, parents, males, teenagers, male students, and female students. They can also call us at 708-672-4909 and just give us the date and the time they want us to speak in their city, and we'll gladly accommodate them.
Now, Doctor, you know, I've only given you a few minutes to talk to our listeners. I really need to have you back on my show so that you can really go into detail about your work. I do want to ask you one last question. Are you doing any sort of work with schools right now that is doing sort of like a rites of passage for young black boys? Have you done any of that kind of work in the past?
Well, maybe about 200. And we also work with organizations developing mentoring programs, Saturday academies, urban prep or single gender schools. So we're doing a lot of work with homeschool. For example, there's over 100,000 African-American parents who are homeschooling their children, and they're doing a fantastic job. So we work with a myriad of organizations that are trying to empower African-American youth, but definitely over 150 to 200 rites of passage programs.
Now, when you compare your graduation rates against the other graduation rates, people who don't participate in your programs, do you have any data to show that what you are doing is effective?
Well, in terms of single-gender schools like Eagles Academy, Urban Prep, their graduation rate is closer to 85%. And their students who graduate, 100% acceptance in the four-year colleges. Nationwide, only 71% of African-American males are graduating from high school. And I'm being generous because there are some cities where that number is closer to 50%.
Dr. Chiwanza Kajufu, thank you so much for joining us today. I really want to have you back on my show. I hope you'll come back and we'll give you more time to talk about your work. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing in the community, and thank you for more than 30 years of dedication.
Well, thank you, Lo, and you keep up the good work and have a blessed weekend.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Chiwanza Kajufu, renowned educator and pioneer, talking about the ways to educate black boys in a culturally affirming manner that support their success, and increase graduation rates and educational performance. Next, I spoke to Ceci Alfonso at her home in part one of a two-part discussion. She is a pioneer who worked on consulting with defendants who've been charged with a capital offense. In 1986, she consulted in over 1,000 capital cases working with bilingual Spanish-speaking persons in Cuba, Colombia, El Salvador, and Puerto Rico. In 1987, she wrote one of the first articles on the role of the social worker in the death penalty case. Her work is being archived at Harvard University. So I'm here in the home of a very special woman. I love your home environment. It's so peaceful and so quiet. Tell my listeners a little bit about you. First, tell them your name and a little bit about the extraordinary work that you've done over the years.
My formal name is Cecilia, but everyone knows me as Ceci. My last name is Alfonso. I was born and raised in New York City in Harlem. I'm Afro-Caribbean. My mother was Puerto Rican and my father was an Afro-Cuban. So I, you know, basically come from very good stock. grew up at a time when the goal was to get out of Harlem and have a different life. Now we can't afford to go back into Harlem.
Right. So Harlem's an expensive place now.
Absolutely. So I went to nursing school and left there and finished that. I became a nurse and worked for about 5 years doing that. And then left, went to undergraduate school and in Rutgers in New Jersey. And I have a master's degree in social work, and I'm licensed in New Jersey and in New York. I think what I'd like to share is the work that worked at humanizing that individual that was charged with a criminal offense by our government, essentially, and how, my philosophy was, if you're going to lynch using the means of, electrocuting someone or other means of the death penalty by injection, it's a human being. And I found an opportunity to take on the struggle by developing a practice. Let me start by saying that in 1988-89, I was asked by an attorney to assist him in developing his client's life history. And I knew at that moment that being a social worker and being a woman of color and understanding on some level what the criminal justice system was doing to my community, which had been done in the past, because one cannot deny that the criminal justice system is the 20th and 21st century form of prosecution and oppression.
So for my listeners, I mean, you've been very modest about talking about your experience, but for my listeners, I really want to say that it's my understanding that you were a pioneer in the field of evaluating and taking histories on men, mostly, who are on death row, and humanizing their stories and giving the legal system a view of their life.
Correct. When I say I'm a pioneer, is, and I was, and I continue, I think, to to struggle against, like I said, a system that in lots of ways is very oppressive. But what in 1988, what I found was when this attorney asked me to assist him, I found a system in which the lawyers, the whole criminal justice system that was supposed to be defending these individuals did not have the tools, the skill set, or the understanding of the community that they were going to have to present to the jurors. Mm-hmm. And so clearly I saw an opportunity in which I could tell the story of my client and his and her life, and more importantly, how that person got there. If you look at it and say, well, there are thousands of people who are oppressed, yet they don't commit crimes. So why was it that this particular individual is charged with committing a crime where the federal government feels or the state feels that an appropriate punishment would be death? But what I found was that those who were mandated to defend and protect these individuals did not have the skills, did not know how to articulate the kinds of assaults on human beings that would lead them to commit a particular crime. And I'll give you an example of, I remember I had a case in Baltimore, and the well-intended attorney went into a public housing and came back out, and I was scheduled to meet with him. And when I did, he said, you know, I knocked on the door and asked the lady if I could speak to her, the mother of the client, and I got no information. And I said, oh, just stay right here. I'll be right back. And I went and spoke to the mother and was able to begin the process of developing the trust and developing the relationship that was needed in order for her to help me see what were the issues, the dynamics, the limitations, the failures, and the hopes of this family that could explain how this individual could have committed this kind of crime. And as a result, I also found that I had no choice but to try to educate the legal system as to how to approach our community. From simple things like reaching out to the community of color because you believe that you want to defend them, you want to fight for their rights, you want to protect them, particularly when the state wants to kill them. Then how about reflecting a connection to those people by simply having magazines in the office that represent the people you serve? I have to say that that was received as a brilliant idea.
So what you're saying is you told the attorneys, listen, if you want to connect to your clients when they come to your office, maybe have an issue of Ebony or some Latino magazine in the lobby so they can read that while they're waiting, because that will help them feel comfortable and connect with you without you even saying a word.
Exactly. Because for many of our clients, the class difference, it's the leap is enormous. And so for many family members, it was extremely difficult. It was very high anxiety for them to come from a very poor rural community, because my cases that I had were all over the country. So I would find myself working with an individual who was charged with a capital offense in a rural community, and working in, you know, in Missouri, and then working in New Jersey.
So on a case. Tell me some of the states that you visited. Where did you see these men? I'm assuming most of them were men.
Yes. 95% of my clients in my 30-year career has been men. Some have been men, white men, but the majority of my clients have been African American and Latino. Many of them were troubled and hurt at a very young age, and to articulate that and express that to 12 people who may not have any idea how this individual's life was, what they know, you have to realize that most juries in this country are made up of people who are different from their clients in terms of race, in terms of class, even gender. And so trying to explain to these 12 people, how could something like this happen? How could someone commit such a crime? Required that I testify, that I share that information. I remember having a case in which I had to explain what were the emotional and physical assaults on this client that made him bitter and angry and narrow in his focus. And so I had to explain that although the parent was responsible to the jurors, I stressed that the parent was responsible, but they were not nurturing. They were the kind of parent who would meet their obligations in terms of taking care of their child, but saying, I love you, you're a wonderful kid, was not something that he received. And that was very damaging.
Would you say that that was a theme that was repeated from person to person over your 30 years of assessing men who are on death row?
The dynamics, well, they're not necessarily on death row, because I work on capital cases when the individual was indicted. So in 1988, we went from, in 1988, learning what the mitigation specialist, the clinical social worker's role was. And in that process, we've gone from standardizing it, making it much more a profession, a field where...
So would it be fair to say then that your work was primarily working with men who'd been indicted for a capital crime?
Correct.
And their attorneys were looking for a way to convince the jury that they did not need to be executed.
Right. The task of the attorney was to communicate and convince, really persuade the jury that the punishment, the appropriate punishment for the particular crime in which they have already found this person guilty of, is life imprisonment or life with parole or not even life. Less than life in prison. And so in order to do that, they had to tell the client's story, humanize that client. The client is not just the crime that you've heard about, that you've convicted this individual of. There's more to this person, and let me tell you about this person. Through me, through my voice, through my investigation, through my educating the jurors to very subtle things. For example, attorneys and jurors needed to know in one particular case, the issue was shade. Shade, tone, skin color. In a household in which, in a society in which race, skin color, and tone is value, its value is determined by how light it is. If you're in a household, and in one case, my client was the darkest and was treated. There's an African-American family, and because he was the darkest, he was rejected, he was ridiculed, he was alienated, and that resulted in an individual who did not feel safe in the world, did not feel valued, cared about. And my task was to not only explain that to the jury, but also educate the attorneys as to how the dynamics of race and color get played out in many homes and many families, and how to communicate that, how to articulate that. In another case, I had, and again, this is a young man who was, and another example in terms of race, this is a young man who was very privileged, who lived in a wealthy community, yet would prefer and was accused of committing a crime in one of the poorest, the impoverished communities. When he was arrested, he was found in a barren apartment with no furniture and essentially very filthy. Yet he, 20 blocks away, could have gone to live in his mother's $650,000 apartment. Why? Why would somebody do this and end up being accused of a crime? The way it took me a while, because I had to engage the family and I had to see the dynamics that were operating as opposed to just asking about what was going on. And what I found in terms of race was that this was an individual whose parents, particularly the mother, was very bigoted and would humiliate this child because of his darker skin and darker tone. Yet his siblings were of lighter skin, and they were treated marvelously and rewarded for their achievements.
So if you're just tuning in, you're listening to me interviewing Cecilia, also known as Ceci Alfonso, a 30-year specialist in the area of working with men who've been accused of a capital crime, who need to have their story told to the jurors so that they won't be put to death.
Exactly.
So for my listeners, I just want to be clear. These men are guilty of the offense that they've been charged. The juror, the court system has declared that they are guilty.
The proceedings are, an individual is charged with a capital offense. The attorney defends the individual. The prosecutor must prosecute. The process of selecting 12 people who are going to make a decision of guilt or innocence is a long, sometimes short, but it is a process. It's not just, 12 people come in, we'll pick you. They have to be able and willing to consider, if they determine that it was appropriate, the death penalty. And once that's determined, then the jury will hear the facts of the case, of the crime, of what that individual is charged with, the circumstances that can lead them to conclude or not conclude that this individual committed this crime. Those 12 people will come back, will leave, and determine, let's just say that they determine that this individual committed the crime. They find him guilty. That is settled. Now it's what's the appropriate punishment. And that proceeding is my area of expertise. Mm-hmm.
So for my listeners, if they wanted to reach out to you, if for some unfortunate person who may have a family member that's waiting and they need help, they need someone to present their family member's case, how can they reach you? What's a contact number, a Facebook, a website? How can someone reach out to you?
Well, I can be emailed. Mm-hmm. And that is Cessie, CessieAlf, mm-hmm. CessieAlf, 123@gmail.com. Okay. And my telephone number is 518-928-8199.
Cessie, thank you so much for joining me on 105.3 FM, The Sanctuary.
Thank you.
That was part one of my discussion with Cessie Alfonso, talking about her work, her groundbreaking work, helping defendants charged with a capital crime avoid the death penalty. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM in Troy, New York. To learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. You can also follow us and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary and on Instagram at Twitter at Media Sanctuary. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, or kind regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, which is up next. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Lavonia Mallory, and my engineer is Jonah. Thank you, Jonah. And remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 and 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration. As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.